Jan Korzat, reading scripture this morning, gave you the beginning of one of the parables. This one about a rich man with a foreman who is mismanaging the property. Somebody snitches, somebody always does, and the rich man sends word he'd like to see the foreman in his office. I understand you've been costing me money. I want you to turn in a complete report of how you've handled my estate, and then I want you to find yourself another job. We're not told exactly how the foreman had gotten himself into trouble. Probably he had been overcharging his employer's clients and then pocketing the difference for himself. Whatever it was, he went too far, and someone squealed, and the nest he has feathered so cunningly is about to be knocked right out of the tree. So that night, while his wife sleeps peacefully, the foreman has a conversation with himself. He has been a clever agent. His wits do not desert him now. Well, he says to himself, I got caught. Okay, I took that chance when I played my little game, so I'm not going to waste valuable time crying about it. The question is, what do I do now? I'm too soft to dig ditches, and it would embarrass me to death to have to beg people for help when I've been living so far above most of them these last few years. It doesn't take him long to think of a trick. Perhaps he had already made a list of strategies in case he were ever found out. He knows he will need some friendship and goodwill now that he is out of work, so he puts his scheme into operation. He wakes up early the next morning and begins to call in the people who are in debt to his boss. How much do you owe? He asks the first one, who has rented an olive grove and is paying with olive oil. I owe around 1,000 gallons yet, the man says, and our foreman shoves a piece of paper at him. Sit down and write quickly what I tell you. Instead of a ticket that says you owe 1,000 gallons, make it read 500. That debtor goes out all smiles. And another walks in who owes 1,000 bushels of wheat. Write on your bill that you owe only 800, the foreman says, and out walks another debtor with a happy surprise for his wife. Neither of those debtors seems to have any thought at all for the person who had lent them the money. Apparently, this discounting caper is too good to keep, because the boss finds out about it, and once again he confronts his dishonest manager, whom he has so recently fired. The disciples of Jesus, listening to this story, can guess how angry the boss, the rich man, will be this time, and they are smiling broadly, I would think, with anticipation, as they wonder whether the man's master will throw him bodily out into the street, have him beaten, or put him into jail. So their mouths drop wide open when Jesus says exactly the opposite of what they are expecting. Jesus says, at the end of the story, And the foreman's employer actually paid the foreman a compliment because he had been so careful and clever about taking care of his own future. There's a moment of stunned silence while the disciples try to understand why their devoutly honest teacher would seem to be complimenting a man who was clearly a rogue and a rascal. Later on, in fact, a certain Roman emperor who was once a Christian and then defected and became known to history as Julian the Apostate used this very story to claim that Christ must have been a fraud and not a true Son of God, or he would never have allowed such praise for a petty crook. But the emperor was doing what many of us have done in later centuries, that is, robbing Christ of his humanity by supposing he was too pious to enjoy a story about a man who was a crook, yes, but who also had some qualities he wouldn't mind seeing in some of his own followers. I want you to imagine Christ looking at his shocked disciples with just a hint of a smile at the edge of his mouth, with humor and love and holy purpose combining in his face, and then saying the words that would drive home his point. You know, the children of this world are wiser toward their generation than the children of light, which being translated means it isn't necessary to be dumb to be a disciple. The Quaker philosopher and theologian Elton Trueblood has proved in one of his books that Jesus had a keen sense of humor, that he said things at times with tongue in cheek, used irony and hyperbole and even sarcasm when he was trying to explain his kingdom to his disciples. He hoped, Christ hoped, in the story we are considering right now, that his disciples would understand what the rich man meant when he praised a man who had just cheated him. He wasn't about to hire the dishonest foreman back, but as a man of the world himself, he had wondered how his ex-employee would get out of the mess he was in, and now, in spite of himself, he is impressed. We don't have the exact words of his compliment, but it must have gone something like this. Well, you really are a clever rascal. I have to hand it to you. That's quite a scheme. It's almost a shame that I had to get rid of you. A man with your kind of wit and daring could go a long way. We've all had that kind of grudging admiration for somebody. A teacher gives reluctant praise to a kid who is constantly in trouble, not because he creates a new dilemma every day, but because he gets into trouble so creatively that someday, used right, his imagination could make him a leader. Or we watch a man on trial for some crime we deplore, but he is so firm and unflinching, so unwilling to beg or to grovel, that we admire his courage, even if we hate everything else about him. That's how it was with the boss in this story. And when Jesus says that the sinners are often more clever than the saints, what he seems to be thinking, along with a deep sigh, is this. If only my followers could be that resourceful in doing good. He knew how hard it was going to be to create a kingdom of right relationships in this world. It isn't strange that he would want, at times, a little more of the cleverness he saw in the world around him. Would it be possible, he must have wondered, to borrow some of that energy and ingenuity without borrowing the dishonesty that went along with it? The whole parable should make us remember something else he said once, something we have probably never heard quite well enough. One half of it won't surprise us. In fact, it almost sounds like some of the jokes about Christianity. Be as harmless as doves. The music of spring and early summer around my house is partly the soft, muted sound of mourning doves. It's hard to imagine anything more gentle or peaceful. Hard to imagine any creature less likely to cause trouble. Jesus said, be as harmless as doves. But the other half of the saying has the same sharp thrust in it that our story has this morning. But be as wise as serpents. In those days, people thought snakes were the most cunning of all living things. And Jesus used that piece of folklore to say to his disciples, let's not injure people or run over them, but we don't have to be dumb. If there is any hope of winning the world to our demanding way of life, we'll have to be as clever and resourceful as we can manage. It seems to me that the Quakers may have understood this dichotomy, this fascinating paradox of cunning simplicity, about as well as any of the followers of Christ. There are so many stories about how cleverly they managed to get the right job done without complicating or compromising their convictions. Thomas Huxley, 100 years ago, told about one of them. A Quaker passenger on a sailing ship attacked by pirates. The captain put a pike, a long, sharp spear, into his passenger's hand and ordered him to take part in the life or death struggle. The Quaker calmly replied that his religion forbade him to fight, but that he was willing to stand and wait at the gangplank. Huxley's own words have a nice flavor. He did stand and wait with the pike in his hands, and when the pirates mounted and showed themselves coming on board, he thrust his pike with the sharp end forward into the persons who were mounting, and he said, friend, keep thee on board thine own ship. I think the wonderful teacher who told the parable of the dishonest but clever foreman would love the story of the creative Quaker who adjusted so skillfully to the double demands of that desperate moment. Nothing is clearer, I think, from this parable than that Jesus liked people who got things done. Over and over, his parables turn on sheer energy and foresight. The widow who drives a judge crazy until she gets justice. The bridesmaids who thought ahead and brought extra oil. The vigorous man who found the treasure in the field and then made sure he got it. The friend at midnight who banged away on a neighbor's door until he got that very night the loaf of bread he needed. Christ would not be patient with the life of drift, with the moral and intellectual sloppiness of many who claim to be disciples, who seem to feel that if they dress for church on an occasional Sunday and smile with pleasant goodwill, that they have somehow shown themselves to be good soldiers in the desperate war going on all the time between good and evil. I have been in places, churches, I mean, and one not long ago, where it would not much have surprised me if Jesus were present in body, to see him striding down the middle aisle to ask with considerable annoyance why in the world the church should be so amateurish, why the signboard with the peeling paint, why the messy bulletin with its careless prose, why the anthem not rehearsed well enough, why the pastoral prayer as stale as discount bread, and why the sermon without a hint of thought or organization, why such bumbling along in the same moment we are holding up our hands to a high-tech age to say, listen to us. We have the way of life that brings humanity back to wisdom. But please do not mishear the sermon, or far more importantly, the motive of Christ himself in telling that story. His praise of cleverness does not whitewash the greedy and the violent of this world, no matter how rapidly they seem to get ahead. There was always something more important to Christ than success, even the success of the cause he believed in. So he said it flatly. You cannot serve two masters. You cannot serve the God of some good end and try to reach that end by evil means. Win or lose, first and last, you do right. And there is no coercion in that phrase, you cannot serve two masters. It is simply a quiet statement of fact. The way one might say, you can't walk east and west at the same time. The means by which you act have to be right, or the goal, no matter how good, is corrupted. A man who was Secretary of the Navy under Roosevelt's first cabinet was asked once by a reporter what his code of conduct was. He said he had three rules from which he never deviated. First, to be as bold as a lion when things are going well. Second, when the water reaches the upper deck, to follow the rats off the sinking ship. Third, and most important of all, and here he stopped smiling, when in doubt, do the right thing. But do right, this parable says, with all the intelligence you can muster. Lazy minds and careless thought have never done any honor to Christ or to the church. When we're trying to interpret the Bible, when we're struggling with controversial issues like abortion, the right to die with dignity, the sad antics of a Pee Wee Herman, or even the local school board, it can help to remember that wonderful remark made by Galileo 350 years ago. And if you forget all else, remember this sentence. I do not feel obliged to believe that the same God who has endowed us with sense, reason, and intellect has intended us to forego their use. Thank you, sir, and amen.